take a moment maybe and notice also how you're feeling in terms of post-lunch energy. It's not unusual for there to be a little bit of drowsiness, and sometimes just putting a little intentionality into the torso in terms of a sense of how it tends to sort of lean forward, shut down, and want to go to sleep, taking our mind with it. And there's something about lifting up the body a little consciously can be useful. So, I was speaking a little bit before we had our lunch around the desire and craving and attachment that arises in relationship to sense pleasure, to sensual gratification, and the way we look for that, and the way in which sometimes the desperate sort of scrambling to get satisfaction in that way gives rise to a lack of ability to deeply connect with what's happening where we are, because we're really asking of it something more than it can give, the experiences, that is. We're asking of the enjoyable thing to somehow fill us in a way that no experience can. So, becoming aware of how often, how much we're preoccupied with that sense of getting what is comfortable or pleasurable, which we anticipate will be satisfying or fulfilling. And just really noticing that. Noticing what the effect of that process is for us. Because it's all very well to hear that the Buddha taught this or that, or that today the message is being repeated, perhaps to see the danger and the limitation and in pursuing satisfaction through taking hold of or attachment to things. And yet we have to really see in our own experience what the effect of it is. And as we start to see that, it's also what allows us to really find the willingness and the courage to let go, to be willing to see what actually happens if I don't put so much energy into trying to pursue or maintain pleasant experience, into avoiding or removing unpleasant experience. What actually happens? That's something we have to really know for ourselves. And yet, in some ways, it's the most obvious level of craving and attachment that we are asked to work with. And that, by saying it's obvious, doesn't mean that it's therefore something to be treated casually or without a considerable degree of respect as a challenging area of life. But the Buddha spoke of four areas, of which that was the first. And I'd like to just lay them out and speak a little bit about each one. The second area that the Buddha spoke of was what's generally translated as the craving or the attachment to rites and rituals, clinging to rites and rituals. And sometimes to do with sort of rites and observances. And it's something which I think as Westerners we can easily imagine isn't too much of a problem for us, because we tend to be quite disinclined as a bunch, I think, to sort of taking on too much sort of random bowing and lighting of candles and imagining that that's somehow going to liberate us. It's something we maybe associate with more traditional religious observances. And I think it's useful to reflect on this in terms of what it really means, and it's not something that's often talked about, I think, that it's the idea that some kind of particular thing, if we do it, will do it for us. So, you know, traditionally, classically, it might be so if I say my prayers, or I do my bows, or I light the candles and incense, or whatever it is, or that somehow will gain me entry to heaven or liberation, however we conceive that. And we, many of us, probably aren't so likely to be enchanted by that kind of idea. Well, maybe we are, I don't know. But something much more fundamental that underpins that whole kind of activity is the sense that there is a way or a thing which, if done just so, will somehow bring about the resolution, the conclusion, the fulfillment of my longings, my needs, my journey. So the sense of something will do it for me, which is quite a nice idea really, since it saves me having to do it myself. But it also means that if I just get it right, and what it tends to do, it tends to bring, this is where there comes a lot of tightness around such things as rituals, like having to do it just exactly right, because otherwise it won't quite work. Now, we might say, so I'm not convinced that this is something I'm that likely to be involved with. It doesn't sound particularly attractive or compelling to me. And yet, we can really get invested in the forms of our meditation practice in a way that actually kind of starts to look very much like this. Like, if I just walk really slowly, that'll do it. You ever have that kind of thought? Or if I can sit just so. You know, it's really interesting. I've observed over the years, and 20 years now I've been doing this thing where I involve sitting in front of a whole bunch of people who are sitting looking at me. And I have seen with somewhat alarming regularity that if over the course of time, it wouldn't necessarily happen in just half a day or more as we've been here together, if I put my hands out here on the ends of my legs near my knees, over time the proportion of people doing it like that will increase significantly to the point where the majority of people are doing that the most of the time. I haven't said a word about where you put your hands when you sit. And if I put them together in my lap or by my belly and just put them like this, I noticed that over a period of time, it happens that way too. And it's very interesting for me that. So actually I make a conscious intention to vary it and make it random. Because I'm not trying, or sometimes I will actually talk about it here in a situation like this, because what we unconsciously are doing, and this is at least how I understand it, and I've seen myself do similar things. It's like watching the teacher. How does the teacher do that? They do it like that. Okay, I'll do it like that. Oh, they lean a bit this way. Okay, I'll lean a bit this way. You know? We start to imagine that there's a particular way where if I do it, that must be the right way. And if I do it that way, then that's somehow going to make the difference. Yeah? Just really subtly. We look, we observe, we absorb. And we don't ever think, oh, I've got to sit looking just like the teacher in order to get enlightened. Now, you wouldn't want to look like me, that's for sure. But, you know, we don't even have the thought, yet something in us starts to operate that way. In some way or form. It might not be in the sitting, it might be something else. It might not be the teacher, it might be we see someone else. Oh, they've been practicing a long time, they do it like, oh, that's the way you do it, okay. I mean, there's a way, of course, we can learn from each other and from people who have experience and skillful ways of engaging about what is skillful. And we can learn, that's fine. But what easily gets added is that little piece, well, that will do it for me. That's where the attachment, that's where the clinging comes in. It's that way in which we've projected onto the form the potential for some kind of completion, fulfillment, satisfaction. And it's that we can be really, it's really useful to be interested in terms of practice. There are places one can go, and sometimes it happens, you know, around retreats at Gaia House or elsewhere, where you can see that there's people who really know that the way you do walking is slowly. And if anyone should walk through the space really quickly and apparently not so mindfully, there's almost like a something, just a moment, you've just, you know, trampled on my sacred thing. What's happening there? What's happening? Often we start to make something of a rite or a ritual about the way we do it. And it might be really useful that we walk slowly and mindfully. It is, actually. I'm not saying it isn't. But then we add something to it that suggests if somebody else doesn't, they're messing with mine? No, not at all. Not at all. And you often see the attachment in the way in which it starts to feel offensive or disrespectful or sacrilegious, let's go all the way, you know, to somehow do it differently than everyone else is doing it. And that's telling us somehow about what happened there, how we kind of, and we form these ideas. And, you know, there's something It's not to judge the tendency again, because the belief that creeps into the back of the mind is the sense of, if you do it the right way, it's going to really work. So someone doing it the wrong way, or me doing it the wrong way, it's not going to work. It's like, I better make sure that doesn't happen. Because of course we care about the outcome. We're not just here for a, you know, another random day. There's some intention and wholesome intention behind our being here. But noticing this, seeing this, you know, there's this great story about a Zen monastery, and every time the students were practicing, this cat would come in and start to bother the students, and initially the master just didn't want to make anything of it, you know, deal with it. But then after a while, some of the students, it would jump on their lap, or it would scare them, or, you know, and so they would take it and lock it in the small room next door, you know, when they were practicing. And so this was how it was. And then they practiced, and every time it would come, they would lock it in the small room next door. And then, you know, the story records that over some period of one or two generations, when the Zen master had died and then the cat had died, they went and got another cat and locked it in the room next door when they meditated. And suddenly, something that was simply pragmatic becomes what you have to do now. And then, of course, you argue with the people who do it differently. And sometimes you have wars with them. And sometimes, of course, the war is inside. So look, be interested to see. Where have we created some kind of an orthodoxy, a tyrannous orthodoxy about how it has to be here? Without losing the sense of respectfulness for each other. That, sure, if someone's walking really slowly, it isn't that supportive if you go rushing past them at high speed and leaving them almost no space, because they'll feel impacted by that. But on the other hand, if one feels moved to walk at a brisker pace, one can. Even something like a 45-minute sitting or a 30-minute sitting, it becomes religiously significant to us in that we have to sit for that long because that's the meaningful length of time. The number of occasions I've heard someone speaking, you know, I can almost sit for this long, as if somehow it's this great failure that they can't quite yet sit for 30 minutes or 45 minutes or whatever it is, because that's what we all do together. So surely that's what we're supposed to do, isn't it? But, you know, we just made it up. The numbers got made up in terms of how long we sit for. The Buddha never owned a watch. Actually, I'm pretty confident. I don't know. But I don't think there were any watches at the time. So I'm guessing he never owned a watch or anything more precise than a sundial. So the idea of a 30-minute or a 35-minute sitting being different, where would that come from? Except from the tendency we have to make things carry more significance in those terms than they actually do. And sittings today have been quite random periods of minutes, you may have noticed. Now, it wasn't that I'm doing that to sort of deliberately stir up any sense of, someone else thinks it should be this long and it's not. It's actually more because I notice I carry the orthodoxy myself, thinking, well, we should really sit for 20 minutes or 30 minutes. And I'm thinking, some other parts of me saying, it makes no difference if it's only 17 minutes or 22. It really doesn't. And yet I can see that part of me thinking, well, it'd be good if it's a bit longer or if it's that much, huh? So, no, it's not. It's just this amount of time. Don't make anything more of it. So interesting to see how that goes, to look for ourselves where it shows up. And what distinguishes that sense of, if it's just so, then somehow that will produce something more than just the so-ness of it. You know, it'll, so if it's 30 minutes, then that will be something more than just the fact that actually it was 30 minutes, which is no different than the sort of the fullness of it was 27 minutes or 23 or 46 or whatever it was. And the third area of clinging and detachment that the Buddha spoke of was the clinging to views and opinions. And the Buddha spoke often of this as a fetter, a thicket, a place one gets stuck and entangled. And it's very central to the Buddha's teaching, is the understanding of the danger of views and opinions. And Views and opinions are attractive things. I certainly can confess to having a few of my own, and I suspect most of you likewise would be able to acknowledge a few. Others aren't views and opinions, of course. Some of the things, they're just how it is. It's not my view or my opinion. That's the way it is, isn't it? Which is the sign of a real view and opinion. When we don't actually know it as a view and opinion, but we believe it to be so. And don't acknowledge the subjectivity in it. And so we are invited to become aware of the way in which our looking at things and the conclusions we form limits what's possible for us. And as Suzuki Roshi said, and very famously often quoted, in the beginner's mind there are many possibilities, in the expert's mind there are few. The problem with being attached to views and opinions is that if they don't accurately and fully describe the truth of things, then we very quickly and easily narrow down what is possible for us in terms of understanding that truth. And, you know, we're very aware of the amount of conflict that arises in our lives and in the world about different views. You know, when religions become attached to fixed viewpoints, they end up in war with other religions that started off to liberate people but ended up being the basis of just a further bondage. And it's such a strong thing for us to know, to have the basis of certainties, to be right. It gives a sense of security. It gives us a sense of safety. And we get very attached to this. It's one of the greatest obstacles we have to deal with, particularly in this modern Western culture where sort of our intellectual capacity has been held up as our central human sort of evolutionary development and the thing that is really going to lead us forward, despite the quite apparent evidence that where it's leading us may not be what we were really looking for. For all the benefits and the advantages and the wonderful advances that have been made through, you know, the developments in Western culture, there's this thing that sort of advocates the primacy of mental positions, of views, of ideas, of information, and it gives a lot of security to us. It gives a sense of safety. We tend to find it uneasy to be unsure. We tend to want to know. And so it's not that, I mean, the Buddha had various things he suggested were good views to have. But it's more noticing how we attach to our views and what that gives us. Voltaire once said that doubt is indeed an uncomfortable condition. But certainty? Certainty is ridiculous. And it's true. There are very few certainties in this life. In fact, the only absolute certainty in this life is that it will end. And that particular certainty doesn't make us feel quite so secure. We don't find certainty in that way. And again, I'd like to share an experience that happened to me some years ago that really gave me a very powerful and visceral insight into the strength of attachment to knowing how things are and the way in which we have our views about things and what we get from that. I was about to be teaching a retreat in New South Wales, Australia. I just travelled to this monastery, Wat Buddhadhamma, in the Darug National Park, and the retreat was beginning the next day, and I'd arrived and they'd given me a little cootie cabin in the woods to stay in, which was some distance from where the retreat would happen, you know, maybe 20 minutes walk. And I was just settling in and thinking, oh, I was quite sort of jet lagged and woozy, so I think I'd go for a run, as I often like to, it would help settle my body from the travel. And so it was pretty warm, it was like February or something in Australia. And I just, wearing a vest and shorts and my running shoes, went out on the track and just going up through the hills. And after about 15, 20, maybe 30 minutes running, I noticed, and it was all very dense rainforest, you couldn't see out, and I was really hoping I'd get to see a bit of a view. And then I saw off the track, but up the hill, what looked like a sort of a high point that might be clear enough for me to see out. And I thought, oh, I'll go up there. I'm quite experienced in the outdoors and confident, relaxed about sort of that sort of thing, going off the track. So just went up the hill, following the line of the curvature of the hill. Just had a reasonably clear sense of where I was and what I was doing. Got up to the top, it was maybe 10 minutes or so off the track, and couldn't see really very well at all. Looked a little bit around the area, still no view, thought, shame. So headed back down to the track. And after about 10, 12, 15 minutes heading down from that point, I started to think, oh, I should have got to the track by now. Maybe I was going up for longer than I thought. Went down a bit further. Another 5, 10 minutes. Oh, for sure, I've missed the track. I didn't find the track. Well, that's surprising. I really paid attention to where I'd left it and where it was. So I'll just go back up to the top and I'll find it, no problem. I went back up to the top, found the place where I'd started from, where I'd got to on the top, and thought, I just checked, because I, you know, noticed where the sun was, checked what the basic lie of the hill was, the orientation of the hill was, and I thought, so it's going to be down there. Okay, so I just went off down there again, and I went down, and I was really paying attention. Oh, gosh, it's not down there. It must be down here. So I went back up, and I went back down. I did this 4 or 5 times, and it was getting dark. And I kept thinking, it's down there, I know it's down there, I'm sure it's down there. And it actually got dark enough, so on the relatively steep and relatively densely wooded ground, I decided, it's going to be dangerous to keep going up and down this looking for the path. But at least I know where it is, it's down there. I just have to find it. And as it got dark, I think, gosh, I'm going to be out here all night, possibly. And I even started gathering some leaves and some things to sort of lie down on, thinking, oh, I'll start again in the morning. But I wasn't really worried. I was thinking, oh, they've got snakes and scorpions and spiders and all sorts of horrible things in Australia that you don't find in New Zealand, where I come from. or, for the most part, England, where I live now. But I wasn't really worried. It was kind of, oh, yeah, I'm supposedly confident, experienced outdoors person, I'll be all right here. And then I was sitting up on this spot where I'd made somewhere a sort of a bit of a heap to lie down on to rest in. It wasn't cold. I thought, I'm not going to die of exposure. It's fine. It's all right. Mildly embarrassing, you know, I couldn't find the path, but I'll find it in the morning. And then the moon came over the hill, and suddenly the amount of light was enough to really be able to see again. And so I was looking and just reflecting, thinking, and then this thought occurred to me. It's like I was sitting there in the sense of, I know where the path is, it's just down there. But then this thought came up. It said, but Yanai, you've been down there 6 times. You didn't find it. The path is not down there. You don't know where you are. You're lost. You have no idea where the path is. You could have got 180 degrees disoriented and you're facing in the wrong valley. You don't know where you are. And this visceral terror just burst. Those thoughts took a microsecond. This visceral terror just burst through my whole system. And it was like, I'm going to die out here. I'm going to die out here. And no one is going to know. Not even going to notice that I'm dead until, or gone until the retreat starts tomorrow and I'm not there. You know? And this incredible, I can virtually feel the electric quality of it in my body just speaking about it. It's 8 years ago this happened. In the moment that I acknowledged that I did not know where the track was, it was terrifying. And up until that moment, I had been holding on to the belief that I knew where it was. In flying in the face of the very clear evidence that where I thought it was, I could not find it. It was not there. And there was this, and it was just like, it just like cleaned me out. I was sort of shaking virtually afterwards. And a few moments later, I thought, well, if it's not down there, maybe it's down here. And I thought, you know, you look down there, it's not there, but it's going to be somewhere. So why don't you go down here? Well, you're sure it's not. And it was enough light with the moon, like I broke a stick off a tree and used it to go down. And it was really funny going down there, because there's part of my mind saying, you know it's not down here, it's down there, you know it's not down here. 10 minutes down there, there it was, path. Happy person. And made my way back to the cabin. Rather covered in scratches and soot, because the bush had burnt sort of a few years ago. It was a very salutary lesson for me. You know, when I reflect on it, what happened was my unwillingness to admit that I did not know where I was, and my dependence and reliance on the belief that I did, which made me feel safe, prevented me from finding my way out of there. And I could have stayed up there till I died, looking for the track and the place I was sure it was, and being unwilling to look where I was convinced it was not. Very interesting. Very interesting. And so this process, this practice, asks us to open our mind, to not be so sure that we know what it is even that we're looking for, let alone whereabouts it might be found. Because the very tendency of the craving and attachment is to be looking in a certain way outside of where we are, looking towards something, some situation, something that's going to do it for me, as I said, or some perspective that's going to be what gives me what I'm looking for. And all of this is very compelling, but ultimately it binds us, and it makes us, or it limits our ability to turn, as it were, on the spot, to reorient ourselves in the very location that we are, in such a way that would actually allow us to know, to see, to realize what we're looking for, what we're interested to understand here, but without having found anything different or gone anywhere else. So this way in which these views that we have are so compelling is really to be examined, to be looked at. I mean, one of the things that we see in the sort of the modern day discourse or dialogue around sort of Buddhist teaching is that, you know, the question of, do we really have to believe in rebirth to be a real Buddhist? You know, can't we just leave all that stuff that happened, or that's not going to happen in my lifetime, by definition? Can't we just, you know, not go there, or something like that? And, you know, the traditional positions that say, well, it's like this, you get born and then you get reborn and then you get born again, and it just keeps going on, you know, all of that. And the idea of Buddhism and Buddhist practice is to avoid getting reborn, so we want to stop that. You keep getting born, but you've got to stop getting born. You know, that's one way we can understand or talk about it. And then there's another view that says, no, there's no such thing as rebirth. That's just some old sort of religious sort of fantasy to make us feel better about the fact that we're going to die. And what's interesting to me is that we have this kind of view, some of us, about another kind of view, but without acknowledging that this is a view as well. Wherever we are in the view, we don't know. None of us really know what happens after we die. To say that there will be something after I die might make us feel better. Well, it depends, it might not make us feel better. To say there's nothing after we die might make us feel better, or it might not. But the tendency is to attach to whichever one makes us feel better. That's actually what we tend to end up believing. Whichever one somehow makes us feel better. It feels better to think there's nothing. If we're going to take hold of a view, that's the one we'll take hold of. It's like, it all stops. And there's no guarantee that it stops. Or it might be that we feel a bit better about the idea it continues. I'm not quite sure how or in what form, but it continues. And actually, it feels a bit better. Phew, less pressure, a bit more time. But, you know, there is no guarantee that it continues. There's no guarantee that it stops. There is no guarantee that it continues.
Doesn't matter.
It matters. Not that we answer the question, but that we see our tendency to fixate in one position or the other. Because really the challenge in terms of the teaching and the practice is to stay in the place of openness. The openness that recognizes that we don't know, and that's willing to look and see and explore the territory. In terms of attachment to views, and positions. Just to give, share the words of Nyanaponika Thera, who was a German-born Sri Lankan Buddhist monk, lived in the 20th century. And he once said, I'm quoting from his, approximately quoting, I think, from his book, The Heart of Buddhist Meditation, "True wisdom is always young and always close to the reach of an open mind that has painfully reached its heights and learned and earned its right to hear it." True wisdom is always young. It's something fresh here. It's something that's new, that's available to an open mind. When we fix on ideas and certainties and beliefs, it produces security, but it closes the doors. I felt safer stuck on the mountain. Sure, I knew where I was, but I was much more in danger there. I was much more scared once I knew that I didn't know where I was, but strange enough, I was in less danger. It's a very interesting thing. And so we can reflect on what we don't know and where we hold or carry some sense of certainty about what we believe we know as a way of kind of keeping ourselves safe, of not being fully exposed to the mystery and the vastness and the unstoppable and equally unholdableness of what it means to be alive. So let's take a little time for some walking meditation.